There's an expression I like, which I'd rather have a book recommend a person than a person recommend a book. So you see someone carrying a book or reading a book and you say, oh, I'm interested in this person because of what they're reading, not the other way around. Right. And of course, book recommendations from is a great thing.
Yeah.
But I also think it's such an interesting way to, you know, you see someone reading a book you've just read and you kind of want to go over and talk to them. So I think there is this trend where unquestionably what we wear signals something about ourselves, what we consume signals something about ourselves. And I think we also live in a world where I think we've put too much effort into trying to show the world that.
Right.
And we are in a world where algorithms drive so much of what we consume, which I think tends to lead us into this kind of big echo chamber of only hearing from people who share the same views as us. Right. And I think we have to kind of go back to this world of organic discovery, of how do you introduce randomness into your life such that you find out about something that you hadn't heard of. And to me, that also means more exploration of long forms of content. So as opposed to, you know, listening to the 30-second snippet of this on TikTok, you probably want to actually sit down and really listen to the podcast. I think it's true of going back to actually reading books and not just discovering them based on what Amazon recommends to you. It's go walk through Indigo and pick up books off the shelf. You're more likely to find something new and unexpected than if you always discover things through the digital format.
Welcome to Growth Untold, the podcast where we dive into thoughtful conversations and insightful discussions with world-class people, all with the aim of inspiring, educating, and empowering our listeners.
We are thrilled to have you here with us on this exciting journey to explore the diverse stories and the ideas that have the power to shape the world for the better.
Welcome to Growth Untold, the podcast.
Today on Growth Untold, we're joined by an accomplished CEO who's redefined industries from retail to luxury fashion and sustainability. From driving growth at Indigo to transforming Essence into a global fashion powerhouse and leading Pangaea into a future where sustainability meets style, he is pushing boundaries in every way. We'll explore his journey, insights, and the bold strategy shaping the next wave of retail. Get ready for an inspiring conversation with a true industry trailblazer. Welcome, Krishna Nikhil.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show, Krishna.
Welcome, thank you, Alex. Krishna. Thank you,
thanks
Mina.
Thanks for coming. You look very dapper, I must
say.
No, seriously.
I dressed up for the occasion.
It fits
though.
On
I think
point.
Suit and sneakers is pretty much.
I love it. I love it. And yeah. Turtleneck, or is it just a sweater?
Yeah. It's kind of a mock neck.
Yeah.
A little bit of best of both worlds.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's what I love about it. Because I actually. So. Funny enough, I wore almost the exact same outfit on Jimmy Kimmel a couple years ago.
Okay.
But it was a full turtleneck, and I thought the full turtleneck was too much. So this is a good halfway point.
There you go. Revolutionizing style right now.
Yeah.
Next time you're on Jimmy Kimmel, I will be looking for you.
I'll get you to style me for sure. I'll get you to style me. You know, it looks dapper. Where's the, since we're talking, you know, we're going to be talking fashion.
Yeah.
And you come from the fashion world. What are you wearing? Can you tell us what you're wearing?
Sure. Blazer is from Bottega Veneta from my Essence days.
I love Bottega. Yeah,
great stuff.
Damn.
Oh my
gosh. The sweater is actually from Uniqlo, who make, to me, the best functional everyday pieces. Frankly, it's my favorite brand of the moment. I think both style and quality is top notch.
Okay, noted, because I'm going to Japan and they're all over Japan.
Well,
so I'm definitely gonna get some.
You can also buy it in Toronto.
No,
there's stores everywhere.
But I'm gonna save them for Japan. Don't ruin my moment.
And then shoes are Salomon's, which you'll see sort of everywhere. It's a ubiquitous sneaker right now.
Can you tell me about Salomon? Because I haven't heard of them, and I know On right now is having a moment. Yeah. Everybody's getting into Ons.
That's interesting. On Salomon's, I heard they were really big into the running community. Like every time I hear about Salomon, I hear it's being referenced.
I've never heard of them.
Aha. Yeah. So Salomon is more outdoor trail. sneaker. This particular model has also been picked up by kind of fashion community. So Kith did a collaboration with them at some point. So I think you're seeing brands like Salomon, Hoka, all those kind of outdoor brands. And there's even a great Canadian brand called Norda, which also plays in this space. And I think it's amazing when Canadians sort of build these great brands that can ultimately become global powerhouses.
Wow. Okay. I haven't heard of Salomon. I haven't heard of Norda. Hoka, I knew about, and I own a couple of Hokas, and On, I own one pair. Also bought it in Japan. As you can tell, I only do my shopping in Japan. I save all my shopping until I go to Japan.
Has such a special place in Mina's heart. That's where he proposed as well.
Yeah, that's where amazing. I proposed to my fiance last year as we were wrapping up Evolving Vegan, my food TV travel show. So I love Japan. I'm going back again. Japan's amazing. But I want to talk about Bottega for a second because... So I'm kind of I'm a watch nerd. I'm a little bit of a purse nerd now too because of Emily, and she, you know, Chanel and Prada, and you've got all your kind of purse OGs, but she recently discovered Bottega, and they're one of the few purse brands that are still made by hand, right? Because a lot of these brands don't make their stuff by hand anymore, like Chanel, which is, you know, creme de la creme and very high up there. A lot of their purses aren't made by hand anymore. Bottega's still made by hand. And Bottega, a couple of their bags, I can't remember which ones, but they've got lifetime warranties on them, which I'm brown. And so I'm like, lifetime warranty, that's what I'm looking for. That's also why I got into John Fluvog. I don't know if you know about John
Fluvog.
Yeah. But he's got like a basic, not a lifetime warranty, but he's very much still a shoesmith, so you can take in your boots. They change the soles. They change the laces. And so I love these kinds of brands that go beyond just making the product and handing it off, but kind of offer this service that comes with
it. Look, I think there is a timelessness to some of these brands that have been doing something a certain way for a very long time. And when your fiancé... and you sort of get to Hermes, I think there's also no going back from there. And those are bags, when you see them, you truly see the quality in them versus even a Chanel. And I was speaking to someone at Hermes and they were telling me the person who constructs an individual bag, when they see their bag again, they can identify it as one that they made. And so they send some of the craftsmen or craftspeople to do these like tours of duty in stores. So a guy from France was now working in a store in Miami, and a woman came in with a bag and he said, I made that bag. He could notice that he had made it.
What? That is crazy. Yeah. It's like having unique. A child. It's like, that's my child.
I don't know if parents refer to their kids as I made that, but maybe
that's
they do.
True. Maybe.
Mina's
You'll find out.
Mina's foreshadowing right now.
I made that. That is amazing. Okay, what about men's brands? Some men's brands that stick out to you. Like, I didn't know Bottega even made a suit, but when you walked in, I was like, that is an amazing suit. So now I'm going to be looking out for their... I got to go to a Bottega outlet or something. I don't know if they have outlets, but...
Look, I think you end up in this place where the stuff that lasts the longest in your closet, those are the brands you're going to go back to all the time. Yeah. For me, that I think Prada does an incredible job with everything they do. I find it endures in my closet. That's true of Bottega, Cucinelli, and The Row. Like, those are the kind of four brands that I feel like...
What was the last one?
The Row. This is Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen's brand.
Really?
Yeah, they've built a really, you know, exceptional fashion brand at a recent fundraising round, was valued at $1 billion.
Man, good for all these. I mean, a lot of these celebrities are just building insane billion-dollar valuation brands now. I mean, Rihanna with Fenty. Right?
Yeah. Who else?
And I did. Who
the
else?
Rock? Did The Rock do something? No. That's,
well, The Rock has tequila. Taramana. Well, you got Taramana's. Yeah.
Selena Gomez with Rare Beauty. Haley Bieber with Rode. There's a lot
Kardashian,
of them.
Kendall with her makeup line. She's a billionaire.
Kylie, of course, one of them. Kim Kardashian with Skims. There's a huge number of celebrity created brands, but it's also sort of was a moment, and we'll see if it lasts.
Yeah. You got Pharrell Williams with Dharma Jam.
There you go.
That's the next biggest.
We're not valued at $1 billion yet, but you can help us get there. No, I also love Zegna. Zegna mm-hmm. menswear. I love them. They're probably my favorite brand. But again, I didn't know Bottega made such a nice suit. And the quiet. Tell me about the quiet luxury space. Why do you think there's been a shift now in people just flocking to quiet luxury? Mm-hmm. Like, there's no branding on that suit, right? Mm-hmm. And there's no branding on a lot of the you know, fashion pieces that are coming out now. People are really swaying to that, like you said, pieces that just last a long time. But there's no branding all over.
Yeah. From my perspective, these are all just engineered cycles, right? Where we went through a very loud logo-driven moment, you know, with Gucci and others really kind of taking up a lot of the airspace, and Gucci went through incredible growth during that time. And now there's a quiet luxury moment where everything is more subdued. But look, fashion does play off what's happening in the world. You know, after going through COVID and, you know, the cost of living crisis that happened, it was just a moment of quiet luxury. I'm sure the trend will change in 3 to 5 years and we'll be all talking about logo mania again. These cycles just continue to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even with watches now, like I said, I'm a big watch guy. And with watches now, so men's watches got really big. Mm-hmm. What was in was big, right? So big Rolex pieces, Richard Mille, huge pieces, right? And now you're seeing the trend reverse into smaller pieces. So you're seeing someone like Michael B. Jordan. He's always rocking smaller Piagets now. You're seeing, you know, a lot of these celebrities kind of rocking smaller pieces now. So small is coming back in, which ties in with the no logo, you know, quiet luxury. So it's really interesting.
It is. No, absolutely. I think there's like an interesting movement that's happening to like a minimalistic look these days, right? As opposed to, you said, like everything was like loud in your face. I love the way you articulated it. But if we can, I want to take a step back further. Just curious, you obviously are an incredibly fashionable guy, and you've come from a strong retail and fashion background. Like, why fashion? What got you into this space in the first place?
Yeah, my path definitely wasn't linear. So
it's all over the place.
Yeah,
right? You know,
first generation immigrant, went to school for engineering, went to U of T, did my undergrad in the engineering science program, then did a master's in biomedical engineering, realized, okay, research engineering is not for me. And then started my career at the, you know, beginning of the first e-commerce bubble in 99. So
right before the 2000 bubble.
Correct. Before the crash. So worked in e-commerce business development at a financial services company, then went to a startup called SKU Logix, was one of the highest funded Canadian startups in history at that time, really focused on helping fashion brands go online. It did not fully make it through the bubble bursting. I joined the management consultancy McKinsey in 2003, was
cool.
Kind of that wild card hire of amongst all the Harvard, Wharton, Stanford MBAs, let's also have this guy who came from a startup, has a master's in engineering, will probably last 6 months.
And startups at the time were not as popular or revered as they are now.
That's exactly correct. It was a complete sort of wild card profile. And I remember at McKinsey, in your first few years, you do this thing called a random walk. You try many different projects. So I did something in retail, did a project in the airline industry, did one in technology, and I was sort of on my fourth project, and I really wanted to work in banking for some reason. I thought, this will be really cool. I'll get to be in the financial district wearing a suit and tie. And so I had my eye on this banking study, and the senior partner comes to me and says, hey, I'm doing this growth strategy study for a US specialty retailer, one of the coolest fashion retailers out there at the moment. And I say, no, thanks. I'm going to do my next study in banking. She just looks at me like I'm absolutely crazy. She says, I have 40 emails in my inbox of people from around the world who want to be on this project. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure for that banking project, there's zero.
Yeah.
You can make your choice. I jumped on that project, one of the best experiences of my life, because we were doing field work in all these different countries. We're doing focus groups in the UK, Japan, Germany, France, to understand the potential for this US specialty brand to go global. And I think sometimes you have to look for those signals of what direction is my career going to take me in. So many people have this idea of, I really want to do this, and you're kind of going against the current. And so as much as retail, culture, fashion was something that I was always interested in, I never thought it was going to be a career. Right. Until sort of this tipping moment happened, did that project, ended up doing more retail work at McKinsey, made partner after sort of 6 years. And that's kind of what brought me to this point, being the CEO of a fashion brand. Again, something I never would have thought as possible.
Well, yeah, that set you up, because I mean, as a CEO, right, I'm not, you know, I'm not hiring, but as someone who's looking for a CEO of a company, someone who has a research background, doing all this research as, you know, the very beginnings of your career, that like, that's amazing. And tell me about you. You said you were an immigrant. So where did you immigrate from, and where did you immigrate to? And who were your parents? What were they
like? Yeah, I was born in Sri Lanka. We then went sort of to the UK, you know, when I was 1 year old. Sort of from 1 to 5 was in London. And then when I was 5, we came to Canada.
And what brought your parents to London? Like, what did they do for work?
I think it was opportunity. I think my parents also had the foresight to see the path to a good life, and the path to citizenship was much more straightforward in Canada. And, you know, they were comfortable in Sri Lanka. They were comfortable in London. But I think they made sort of the biggest sacrifice for future generations to come to a place that is extremely different. And I think it's been eye-opening for me, even going back to London as the CEO of a company. It was incredibly evident to me how different Canada is from the UK, and the difference in opportunity creation for people of color.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Canada, what decade was this, back in the 70s?
So yeah, born in the 70s, came to Canada in 1980.
Yeah, so the 70s, 80s in Canada, I mean, the amount of opportunity there was to build something was insane. I mean, I immigrated to Canada in the 90s, but even back then, like, we grew up in Markham, and Markham back then is so different than it is now. Like, the change is insane. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I imagine that the amount of opportunity was vast.
Yeah. And look, I think in Toronto, especially, I think as a person of color, you don't feel like there are limits to what you can achieve. Like, you'll see a bank CEO who's a person of color, or the head of the biggest telcos in Canada can be a person of color. I don't think you see that level of, I can look around and see people like me. And I think it's particularly true in cultural industries.
Right.
If you look at the world of, you know, that you're in,
entertainment.
Of entertainment, the world of luxury and fashion, those are not inhabited, especially in its executive ranks, with people that look like us.
Yeah.
They are, it's very European or North American centric of who gets to have those jobs. And I think it's a really interesting thing when you're trying to become part of that world and create those opportunities for yourself.
Yeah. Okay, so your career in retail has taken you from Indigo to Essence to Pangaea. What are the things that drew you to this particular field? Like retail and sales, what drew you to that?
Yeah, for me, I think being in retail and working with brands, there is this unique intersection of culture and commerce. To me, that's the great thing about trying to build a brand. It's this blend of art and science that it's not reductive. You can't take it apart like a watch and put it back together, because you're dealing with consumers and their preferences and different trends. And I think that's what makes consumers so interesting. It's unpredictable. And there is this blend in art and science, and you can You have to be incredibly data-driven and operationally oriented at times. And other times you have to be big picture, vision, bold. And I think that sort of blend suits the things that I enjoy.
So do you think even with books, because, you know, fashion, when you talk about trends, I get that. But with books, do you think there are trends even in selling books?
Absolutely. You look today, book talk, right, you know, on TikTok is one of the most popular content categories. When I was at Indigo, that sort of Instagram poetry, people like Rupi Kaur were taking off.
Right.
There's genres of fiction that have moments, different types of nonfiction. So I think we're just, as humans and consumers, we're always driven by different types of trends. And whether you're in book retailing or fashion, sure, I think it's most commonly applied to fashion, mm-hmm, but that's true in any type of retail.
Right, because fashion is like, you wear it, people see it. It's a reflection of who you are. People want to, mm-hmm, make a statement. They want to say something about themselves. So that's what they wear. And I guess you're right. It's the same with books, but you can't, you know, you're not going to carry around the book that you're reading. Some people do on the subway.
I think it's literally a recent trend from either it was New York or Paris Fashion Week. A large number of people carrying books that they're reading, which signals something about you.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That's so interesting.
I think there's some commonalities and some areas of, obviously, we're talking about the areas that, like, that are dissimilar in terms of consumer trends, but are you noticing some patterns and the signaling people are doing with the clothes they wear, the books they read, and what are maybe the different consumer trends you're noticing in those sectors?
There's an expression I like, which I'd rather have a book recommend a person than a person recommend a book. So you see someone carrying a book or reading a book and you say, oh, I'm interested in this person because of what they're reading, not the other way around. Right. And of course, book recommendations from is a great thing.
Yeah.
But I also think it's such an interesting way to, you know, you see someone reading a book you've just read and you kind of want to go over and talk to them. So I think there is this trend where unquestionably what we wear signals something about ourselves, what we consume signals something about ourselves. And I think we also live in a world where I think we've put too much effort into trying to show the world that.
Right.
And we are in a world where algorithms drive so much of what we consume, which I think tends to lead us into this kind of big echo chamber of only hearing from people who share the same views as us. Right. And I think we have to kind of go back to this world of organic discovery. Of how do you introduce randomness into your life such that you find out about something that you hadn't heard of? And to me, that also means more exploration of long forms of content. So as opposed to, you know, listening to the 30-second snippet of this on TikTok, you probably want to actually sit down and really listen to the podcast. I think it's true of going back to actually reading books and not just discovering them based on what Amazon recommends to you. It's go walk through Indigo and pick up books off the shelf. You're more likely to find something new and unexpected than if you always discover things through the digital format.
Man, I love that. I've never thought about that before, but it's so true. It's like, even people used to pick up the newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. You used to pick up the newspaper so they would see everything that was in the newspaper. Now you're just like, it's clickbait. So you're just seeing things that speak to you. You're reading one article,
exactly,
one column, one opinion. You're not exploring all the different things out there. It's so true. Well, it's the same with clothes too.
Yeah, it's true with,
right?
Yeah.
If you walk around in a mall or a shopping area and you're going from shop to shop, you might see something that really speaks to you, something that you're like, wow, this is me. But now people do all their shopping online. It's honestly, I get stuck in that too. So Emily the other day was like, we have to throw out all your trousers because they're skinny and slim. And she said, wide is coming back in trend now. The wide. And I was like, yeah, I wouldn't know that because I don't really go like shopping, you know?
I think it's literally been every single thing we do. You think about travel, where before you would go to a place and, you know, have a sense of, you're going to discover some things. And now people go to a place and they have 10 photos they need to take because they saw them on Instagram. And those, all those exact same places get overrun with people.
Yeah.
And now what have you done? You've sort of gone and traveled to a place just to be all around a group of tourists. You haven't learned anything about that place. I actually find traveling for work is frankly more authentic now than leisure travel, because you actually get to interact with real people from that country.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's so true. So at Essence, Essence is basically a luxury retailer. You carry over 500 luxury brands. So you had your pulse on what was in, what wasn't in. How does a company like that curate what to sell and what not to sell on your site? Because you've ultimately, it's about moving product, and the more product you move, the better for the company.
Yeah.
So you've really got to, you know, be in tune with what's in and what's not. Are there thousands of algorithms, you know, doing the work, or do you have people that are luxury, you know, fashion gurus really back there predicting trends and getting ahead of it? How does that work?
Look, the answer is it's both, and it truly comes back to that idea of art and science. And so for us at Essence, the science part was the guardrails and boundaries that we put into place of, well, if we want to grow by X amount, we need to buy this much volume and this many different styles, and the average depth per style, meaning the number of units of each item we buy, is this. And then we would sort of calculate all of that even by brand. We'd say, let's look over the last six seasons. How is this brand performing? Is it ready to grow? Should we hold it flat? So we would sort of go into a season with a very analytically driven plan.
Right.
But now it's turned over to the buyers, who have to inject the taste level into it, where they have to say, okay, I know we went in with this plan, but I really believe in this collection, so we're going to buy bigger into it. Or we'll say, listen, we're going to be onboarding 100 new brands. Now it's up to them to say, is this an authentic designer-driven brand that we can really invest behind for a minimum of three seasons? Or is this just a flash in the pan trend of someone putting graphics on a hoodie?
Right.
And so it is that balance of art and science. We always had this expression at Essence of, you don't blend art and science, because then you get mush. You have to toggle between those two views. So you go in with a very data-informed plan, but then when it's time to really kind of look at the collection and figure out what you want to buy, that's where the art of it takes over.
Do you find that Essence was, it did so well because it was in Canada? Because, and here's what I mean. So living in the States now, having lived in the States for 7 years, I'll give you a great example. Like, there's in the States, or let's say in California, there's tons of Rolex authorized dealers. In Canada or in Toronto, there's like two. And so, you know, there's not as much choice in Canada, I feel like Bottega. I don't know how many stores they have here. So I would probably want to go to a platform like Essence to really be able to do my shopping. In the States, I'll just go to Bottega because they're everywhere. Or not everywhere, but, you know, more prominent than they are here. So do you think Essence benefited from that when it comes to Canada versus the US?
To me, not really. I think unquestionably Essence benefited from being in Canada, in that it was built in a very patient, authentic way. And I think sometimes in the US you can't do that. But for Essence, its biggest market is the US, not Canada.
Wow.
So it's has strong positions in Europe, it has strong positions in Asia. It's a truly global luxury retailer. And I think Essence benefited from the fact that it was very ahead of the curve in terms of trend and perspective. So when sort of the big streetwear moment was happening, Essence invested heavily behind that. We were, you know, Virgil Abloh for Off-White, that one of their first big accounts. We helped, you know, take Jacquemus to where it is. We launched The Row when they were launching menswear for the first time. That was on Essence. And so I think Essence's position with millennials and Gen Z was ahead of the curve. And I think that's a big reason for its growth over that time, right? Between, you know, 2017 to 2021, Essence went from sort of a small niche online luxury platform doing a few hundred million dollars to a $1 billion retailer, and really people understanding this thing has much more scale than we expect. And I think that's kind of what was really cool about the Essence story. It was under the radar, based in Montreal, and then really grew into this global champion.
And yeah.
No, sorry. Out of curiosity, when I think of Essence, you know, I can't help but draw some similar parallels to maybe perhaps StockX and maybe GOAT, right? Now, these are more focused on sneaker culture. What would you say are maybe like some of the differences and similarities between that?
Yeah, to me, they're very different platforms in that StockX and GOAT are sneaker resale marketplaces. People buy things. So those things aren't holding any inventory, but they're also incredibly dependent on a single thing, which is reselling of sneakers. Mm. And so you had that moment of Yeezy, Nike Off-White, and those platforms did incredibly well. And now people sort of aren't quite as willing to pay outrageous premiums for resale sneakers. And the world has changed for those platforms.
Yeah, like Chrono 24. So Chrono 24 is the StockX of watches.
Oh. Yeah, you've got Houdinki and a bunch of others.
And Houdinki's actually getting out of it now because I think they've noticed what you said, which is people aren't willing to spend an exorbitant amount of money on watches anymore. So they got out. So Houdinki doesn't resell watches anymore. They just stopped. You know, it's October 2024. I think they literally stopped a month or two ago. They had a massive sale to just sell all their inventory. And they've gone out for that exact reason. Is I think they noticed we're not going to be able to survive this. And so they got out. So really now it's just Chrono 24 when it comes to watches. But they do what StockX does to shoes for watches.
Yeah. Oh. And Essence was in the space with people like Farfetch, who they had more of a marketplace model. They ultimately were never profitable, essentially were acquired for a very small sum relative to what they were once worth by a Korean company called Coupang. Then there's Mytheresa, which is based in Germany, which has been quite successful in the online luxury space. They just acquired Net-a-Porter to make what will ultimately be the behemoth in the industry. But it's been an industry that had sort of this big rapid growth moment during COVID and then a, you know, restructuring moment after that.
So when you look back at your time at Essence, how long did you spend there?
Spent 4.5 years at Essence, 2017 to 2022.
So like you said, you kind of experienced that big boom there where you went from a couple hundred million dollars to over $1 billion. What was some of the innovation that you're really proud of at Essence? How did you take that company from doing a couple hundred million dollars in sales to over $1 billion?
Yeah. And look, we talked about this idea of how we really drove the merchandising side, how we thought about growing the buy, being still very analytical and data-driven. I think one of the moments that stands out the most to me is the opening of our flagship retail store in Montreal. So somewhat ironic of it's an online retailer, but our retail opening was a really major moment for us. They had built this building with David Chipperfield. He's a globally renowned architect, Pritzker Prize winner.
Yep.
And so this was a real special building. And I had joined as sort of chief merchandising officer, and the CEO sort of 2 months in came in and said, "We're opening this retail store in 4 months. And I feel like I need help on it. You know retail. Can you take this under your wing?" And of course, I said yes to that. But then you also realize the way Essence is opening a retail store is very different than anyone else. We're literally doing the opposite of what anyone would do in retail, where our retail store doesn't actually have any product in it. It's purely appointment driven, so people can kind of take things off the website and then try them on in store. It's intended as a big curatorial space for special exhibitions. So now we have to build all of those things to come in for the launch. And so we're in the lead up to launching this in April of 2018. And we're trying to decide on what should the big opening be. And we have two choices. One is Virgil Abloh, creative director of Off-White, has just been named as the Louis Vuitton men's artistic director. And I sort of think this is the right decision.
Right.
And then there's this performance artist named Arca, who I had not frankly heard of at that time, incredibly influential in the fashion community, has a really powerful, provocative perspective. And this
and
is what
Montreal's really into their performance art
correct.
As well.
That's
yeah.
exactly it. So we're trying, the team really wants Arca to be opening of the store. And for us, this opening of the flagship is this major moment. We're flying press in from around the world. We've got Business of Fashion, top newspapers from Germany, the US. We have a large number of industry people. We had Simone Port, the founder of Jacquemus. We had Ian Rogers, the chief digital officer of LVMH. So we have this giant group, and Arca's performing.
Oh, you guys went with Arca.
We went with Arca.
Wow.
The performance goes on for, I think, an hour, and it is incredibly provocative. And I'm standing beside the CEO, and we're looking at each other, and we think, we effed up. Like, we made the wrong choice. And so this performance finishes, and, you know, one of the editors from this big German newspaper comes over to us, and we think, this is not going to be good. And he says, that was amazing. The best thing I've ever seen. Goes back to Germany, writes this glowing story on it. Same thing with all the coverage, is incredibly positive.
Wow.
And so we also did the Virgil Abloh one okay. later in June. It was massive and also got us incredible press.
Yeah.
But it was one of those moments where you think, okay, maybe we pushed it a little too far.
So the takeaway, what's the takeaway? Is the takeaway that you maybe lean into the culture of where you're launching it versus lead into maybe your gut decision from like a global perspective?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I think one is you've got to trust your creative teams and give them the freedom to take risks and know that you have their back as these things come to fruition. But you also have to create those boundaries. Like, if our creative team had their way, they would have also probably said no to the Virgil Abloh thing, because they're like, this is not kind of cool or of the moment enough. And so we said, no, you have to do both.
Yeah. And how is that retail concept? Because that's the first time I've heard of that. I mean, look, I know when you go into somewhere like Rolex, they don't really have a lot of pieces to sell you, but you can try on their mm-hmm. pieces. You can take a look at them. They're called exhibition pieces, even though there's debate on whether they're actually exhibition or not. But that's kind of that concept, you know, of going in, trying on something, and then buying it later at a later mm-hmm. time. Do you feel like that's where retail is headed, or is it just for luxury goods where that concept can work?
Yeah, I think it disproportionately works well in luxury, the kind of appointment-driven model. Mm-hmm. You know, for multi-brand luxury, that model did not exist. Essence really did create it in a very unique way, where a lot of these luxury stores who have an appointment model, at least in multi-brand, would do sort of 5-10 appointments a day. There was a moment in time at Essence where we were doing 100 plus appointments a day.
Wow.
Where it was, again, a technology powered backbone that allowed that to happen, where you could just seamlessly go onto Essence, add things to your wish list, and then create an appointment. You show up, the stuff's waiting for you. And so, as much as it worked, it took time to figure out that model. And I think that is also kind of the power of having a vision for what you believe in and saying, if it didn't work, but you think there's a opportunity for it, then go fix it, make it better. What are the things that you can do to remove the friction from the experience? And I think having this long-term view of when something doesn't work, you don't just abandon it and try something else. You just work at it harder. I think it's a very founder-driven thing. I think this was very true of Heather Reisman at Indigo. She founded the company and had this incredibly long-term vision, not just of a bookstore, but a cultural department store. And she really stuck through, you know, many doubters in bringing that vision to life. And Canadians are the ones who get to benefit. We have this incredible concept called Indigo that doesn't exist in any other country.
Yeah.
I think Indigo is really interesting. And just in terms of, you ever walking through a store, it's beyond an experience of books. It has mugs, it has like recipe books, it has like candles. It feels like a space where, I don't know, you can, your dwell time there is like actually longer than you always anticipate. Mm-hmm. Like I'm there and my girlfriend's like a big reader.
Yeah.
Like I think she's one of the few that I know that actually she has like a goal of reading like around like 100 to 200 books a year, and she crushes them.
Hmm.
Like, yeah, Denny,
that's
just
a book every 3 days.
She crushes books. Like,
wow.
She, I think it's around that much, but she just crushes them. And they're big books, by the way. I'm the opposite. Like, I can't even read like a paragraph without like thinking what I'm eating tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the same. I need to get better at reading for sure.
But anyways, when you go to an Indigo, it's just very interesting. It's like you get more than what you bargain for. Would you agree with that? Like, tell us about the purpose that went into designing the space and the retail space.
I think it's unquestionably the intent. I think internally, I think when I was at Indigo, we often talked about it as a happy place for customers, for people who visit. And frankly, it wasn't language that we used. It was almost, we saw customers referring to it that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea of kind of discovery, a special place where you just feel comfortable spending time. It's funny, in the US, that used to be Starbucks, but that's just kind of having a coffee and sitting there.
Right.
I think what's special about Indigo is whether you'll see people sitting at tables with books out or people having conversations. I think it's a powerful place for discovery, and ultimately you'd hope also a powerful place for human connection, because I think it's something that is missing from our everyday lives. COVID kind of really changed that, I think, in Canada. And I think we need more places where people just have not only spontaneous discovery, but the serendipity of perhaps talking to a stranger.
Yeah, spontaneous discovery is something that I don't know if it'll ever come back. Even dating, you know, now people don't really go out to restaurants and bars mm-hmm. to meet people. If they want to meet people, they're on one of these apps. So even with the very specific activity of wanting to meet someone, mm-hmm. there's an app for it. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I feel like, you know, our kids are, you know, two generations from now, I don't know that there'll be much spontaneous discovery anymore. And maybe companies will come about that really specialize in that and really take mm-hmm. that and run with it. But I just feel like the whole world now is going to immediate satisfaction instead of spontaneous discovery. And like you said, there's, you know, it's sad a little bit, because there is something about meeting people or seeing people reading a mm-hmm. book and going, I want to connect with them, that like desire for connection that I think we're losing a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of these things are junk food for our brains where they give us the hit of what we think is connection when it really isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, I don't know if any company will come about that's going to change that. I think we as humans have to decide the empty calories of social media and algorithmic discovery are not it. And we will hopefully at some point recognize that going back to reading real books, meeting and talking to strangers in public places is and was a positive thing.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. We're really on dialing in on the topic of trends here. And it feels like, I feel mm-hmm. like you've had a pulse of that being a CMO, chief merchandise officer, being an accomplished CEO. You've got to have a pulse on culture, have a pulse on trends. How are you staying ahead of trends? How are you envisioning trends? I feel like there's a bit of a shift of everything is becoming AI, ChatGPT,
mm-hmm.
if you will, right? And you saying empty calories, people are thinking less and letting things surf its course. So curious, what are your thoughts on just staying ahead of trends for these days?
Yeah. And for me, I think staying ahead of trends sort of comes with that notion of trying to set a trend, when to me, it's less about staying ahead versus knowing what is relevant or not. And so if you're, whether it's a CMO or a CEO, knowing what is relevant for your brand is far more important than chasing every trend. And for me, it's this idea of clarity is the foundation of agility, and focus and discipline is the foundation of longevity. So if you know who your brand is, if you know who your customer is, you can move quickly in response to the right trends, and you'll not chase the wrong ones. And when you have focus on this is what I do and this is what I'm about, then you will have longevity as whether it's a brand or a leader. And I think sometimes people are so quick to chase a trend, they don't actually do the work of, you know, what do I stand for as a brand, as a leader, and is this thing relevant for me or not? And so that's, to me, the foundational part, which is you've got to do the work in order to, whether it's stay on top of the trends or continue to be relevant.
So you went from Indigo to Essence, who sell, you know, thousands of brands to hundreds of brands in Essence's case, to Pangaea, which is just one brand. Tell me about the difference in that, because you go from, you know, being a retailer that's selling so many different brands to really focusing on one brand, one thing you stand for. What's that difference like?
Yeah, it's exactly as I said, which is as a retailer, you can stay true to your curation perspective, but you have lots of options for what you buy and what consumers are going to buy. And with a brand, it's this one thing. And to me, the concept of Pangaea was so powerful. It's why I sort of picked up my life, left Toronto and moved to London for. And really, it's Pangaea wasn't intended to even be a brand. It was intended to be a company that accelerates fashion's transition from planet-harming materials to ones that are less damaging to the planet. Any consumption is going to damage the planet. But fashion is the third most polluting industry in the world, which should be shocking to all of us when you've got things like oil and gas, metals and mining, air travel. Fashion should not be on this list of animal agriculture. Fashion should not be on the top three list. And most of the harmful emissions and pollutants created by fashion come from the choice of materials. Polyesters and nylons, conventional cotton, which is overcropped. All of these materials have better alternatives, which you can farm using regenerative practices to create cotton and wool. You can have bio-based polyesters that then will biodegrade or less harmful to the planet. But the fashion industry has shown very little interest in moving to those new materials. And so Pangaea was essentially this idea of a brand that could be the first one to launch those things. Okay. So we launched a sneaker that was made of grape waste. So it was grape leather sneaker. We made hoodies that were made from brewed proteins in a lab. So you had kind of a lab-grown cashmere product into a hoodie. We had down jackets that, as opposed to being filled with feathers, they were filled with flowers. And so this idea of kind of bringing forward next generation science.
Wow.
But it also runs into the obstacles of, does the fashion industry really want to adopt these next generation materials? And at present, the answer is no, because customers don't care enough to vote with their wallets. They're voting on trend and how it makes me look and all of those types of things.
Do you think we'll get to a place where people start taking the environment seriously enough that they will start making decisions based on material rather than on trends?
I would say I am skeptical. I haven't seen enough information to say, or at least evidence for people to say, this is going to be something we meaningfully care about. If you look at what's happening in the world right now, Shein is positioning itself for an IPO on the London Stock Exchange, valued at, I think, $60 billion or something like that. Temu is one of the fastest growing platforms in the world. It's gobbling up air freight. And so it's almost the opposite is happening. We're getting to more low-priced items, more disposable. And so it will be interesting. I think it will take something even more severe than what we have gone through to drive you know, a real 180 in human behavior around consumption.
I think consumers are really interesting in a sense. So I'm working in like the realm of sports marketing, but I find it really interesting that consumers respond to things that are visible versus invisible. Environmental changes sometimes are not as unless something, you know, insane happens, I think people are going to be less willing to do anything about climate change. The same thing for disabilities. People pay more attention to people who have visible disabilities versus internal things that are going on with you, right? And I think that's for everything across multiple sectors. Mm-hmm. So to your point, I share that, you know, I'm just as skeptical as you, because I think it's just pretty interesting that fast fashion, things that make me look good, the validation from others matters mm-hmm. more to me than this amazing purpose-driven, like you sharing this, it makes so much sense. People should vote for mm-hmm. their wallets. I was watching YouTube videos before you came on of people, all right, we're going to try on the Pangaea hoodie set. Mm. We're going to try on the Uniqlo set. People are like, yo, Pangaea's nice. Mm-hmm. And they're like, holy shit. Yeah. It's a little bit more expensive, but it's really nice. Did you know this, by the way? And they're talking about the sustainability mm-hmm. practice and what it actually stands for. And if people took that chance to educate themselves, I feel like maybe they would do things differently.
Yeah. And look, I think most consumer purchases are not driven by deep education. They're driven by a desire and a want. And I think it is something that companies that are driven by sustainability and a different kind of ethics have not been able to do, right? Where they haven't been able to create that desire to change. But there are always populations that are willing to do that. People who become vegan or vegetarian and change their eating habits because of a belief in something.
Yeah.
And I think what we will collectively realize is if we want a healthy planet, ourselves to be physically healthy and ourselves to be mentally healthy, every industry needs to change, right? We have to think about pharmaceuticals and natural medicine differently. We have to think about social media and digital discovery versus in-person real life things differently. We have to think about what we wear differently, and we have to think about what we eat differently.
I think we're also in a moment in time where we have to care about future generations too. If you don't care about future generations, it's like, why change any of that? Mm-hmm. Because we'll get away with not changing any of that. The world's not going to change that rapidly. You know, I think as our generation and the younger generations become like the baby boomers, where they're having kids and seeing their grandkids, maybe they'll start to wake up and go, listen, you know, all these, you know, all this climate change is happening, all these floods that are happening everywhere, we've got to change things. But as long as we don't really care about future generations, I don't think it'll change.
That's a good point.
I want to talk about Krishna, the man. Mm. Your upbringing, you know, being a visibly ethnic man in the C-suite world, what was that like? Because like you said, you know, you growing up, and even me and Alex growing up, we didn't see a lot of people that look like us in our industries. I can argue that I still don't. You know, you turn on your TV and you know, there's not a lot of people that look like me specifically. Mm-hmm. So how do you go about that? How do you stay motivated? How do you stay inspired? How do you stay driven?
Yeah, I think it's such a great question. And I think there's been progress made, but I think it still happens much too slowly. And I think the other piece of, there's a lot of nuance by industry. So if I'm a person of Indian origin and I'm in the tech industry, I don't think I'm a visible minority, so to speak. I think you have many examples of CEOs from Sundar Pichai to Satya Nadella that, and the workforce is also made up of wide range of people of color. I think if you're a woman in the tech industry, and even more so if you're a woman of color, then you truly are sort of a outlier, and people have to go out of their way to help create opportunities in order to rebalance a system. Now, in our industries, in entertainment, in fashion and luxury, that for people of color, that's not true. We don't actually have real representation. We have token representation. And token representation is great when times are good. Like when times are good and everything's growing, people are, starting D DEI groups and really trying to create kind of these roles for people of diversity. But when times are a little more challenging, those are the first things that they stop and they cut. And this is the moment we're in right now where a lot of lip service was paid to diversity and inclusion. And now it's, we don't really have time for that at the moment. And I think it's something people don't talk about enough because we're supposed to be grateful for all the DEI initiatives that are going on. But I can, from my own personal experience at this moment, it's actually, there's a silent sort of backlash against it.
You literally jumped into my soul and just took it out. It's insane, man. Mm-hmm. No, seriously, it's insane because you're in fashion. I'm in entertainment. You wouldn't think those two are directly related, but so many people in my industry that are afraid to come out and talk about it, including myself, mm-hmm. right? You just worded it so beautifully. You're right. When things were good, and I'll talk about Hollywood now because you talked about fashion. When things were good a few years ago, studios were making tons of films. You know, streaming was booming. Mm. Every studio wanted to make as much content as possible. There was a lot of work to go around. So then it was like, let's put visibly ethnic people at the forefront of things. Let's cast more people. And you can do that because there's just more mm-hmm. stuff being made. And now that studios have pulled back, interest rates have gone up. They're not making as many things. Mm-hmm. They're not taking as many chances. You know, there's people that look like me, you know, visibly ethnic artists going, where did the work go? Like, where did the work go? Mm-hmm. And yes, everybody gets affected, but I feel like we get affected more because they're just not making as much stuff for us out there. So it's crazy that you say that about a fashion because in entertainment, a lot of people of color are feeling the same way. Like, yo, the work just dropped. Like, it just dropped out. They're mm-hmm. just not making as much stuff. So it's really interesting that you say that and talk about token diversity because a lot of us in the industry feel that way too, that it is token to a certain extent. And sure, there are shows that come out that really, you know, make a big bang. Shows like Rami, shows like, or movies, you know, like Crazy Rich Asians, Beef, you know, Squid Game. Those are things that mm-hmm. really make an impact. But when you look deeper, you're kind of like, where's the other stuff? Like it's, you know, you're kind of taking these things that are doing really well, but where's all the other work? So it's really interesting that you say that.
Yeah, and I think you also can see that very clearly at the highest levels. So when the way people are talking about diversity and do they really understand why it's important, I think is not necessarily true. I think they view it as we are doing some group of people a favor and it becomes sort of like a charitable endeavor versus this is a key to keeping our company, our brand relevant over time and that there is going to be a major shift in the world. I do think people have to start thinking about how do you build your own things because the institutions that exist are not always going to create the opportunities you want. And therefore, it's how do you create and build your own, I think is something that I think younger generations are starting to learn.
I do think that's the key because we touched on something too, which is, and I'll speak from my personal experience, you know, I am, you know, a lot of times I am afraid to come out and talk about things that I'm feeling deeply because, you know, as an actor specifically, mm-hmm. you're a hired hand, right? There's a big machine that's involved with making a movie and I'm a tiny, tiny part of it that usually gets put in at the very end once the whole machine is going, mm-hmm. right? We've got to get the financing. We've got to get the set design. We've got to get the director in place. We've got to get all these people to make the machine start going and then we put in the actors. And when that's the case, you're like, well, if I say something, they're just going to hire somebody else. Like, I should just keep my mouth shut. And I truly do feel that mm-hmm. way a lot of the time. And I'm going to be honest, it is because I want to work in the studio system. You mm-hmm. know, I want to work in the studio system. If if I was an artist that was like, I'm just going to be a content creator, I'm going to create my own stuff on my social media platforms, I'm going to create my own stuff on YouTube, and I'm just going to get out there and do my own stuff, I probably wouldn't care as much, mm-hmm. right? Because it's like, I don't need you guys. But when you're an actor that's like, I want to work in the studio behemoth, right? You're kind of like, well, I kind of just got to go with the flow because I'm not going to change the studios. Like, I'm not going to change what these guys are saying and who they're hiring. I've just got to go with the flow. And that's how I do feel a lot of the time.
You have to, you have to get along, or you have to get along to go along, right? And that's part of working in, you know, I come from the sports industry, and the bigger the sports industry you work in, the bigger the machine is. There are certain unwritten rules in place or politics in place. And I feel like culturally you have to be a chameleon. I feel like sometimes I've related a lot to that, of knowing when to speak up, knowing when to show up as your authentic self, knowing when to share what's deeply on your mind. You know, I feel like perhaps, you know, Krishna, you've been somebody who's probably been at the bottom level to now made your way up to the ladder at the height, right? How have you navigated through those unwritten rules, the politics of being somebody who is a visible ethnic minority? There's so few of you. What have you done to pave that path, but also staying true to yourself?
Yeah, I would say the way you behave as a kind of junior entry-level person is going to be the same as you behave as a CEO, right? Like, those behaviors become learned and reinforced. And frankly, you sort of talked about your unwillingness to speak up. The same was true for me throughout my career. And frankly, even to this day, where you feel like there is a version of yourself that people are expecting, topics of diversity inclusion are considered difficult or challenging when really they shouldn't be.
Right. Yeah, it's so interesting. I struggle with it every day. And I mean, it's the whole point of the podcast, really, is to give a voice to the unheard. Same with my production company. That's what our focus is. But it is very difficult because when you're climbing the ranks, like you said, you feel like you just can't say certain things. You can't talk about certain things. And then you hear things in the media where I really struggle with it. Like, I'm a big Elon Musk fan, but then I hear him say that, you know, basically this problem doesn't exist and you just hire the best person for the job and that's how you move the world forward. And so I listen to that and I'm like, maybe I agree. Like, yes, maybe I agree that in movies, if they just hired the best person for the job, there'd be more people of color in leading roles. Like, maybe I agree with that. But then I think to myself, I'm like, but that's not human nature, because human nature is you tend to gravitate towards and want to push people forward that look like you. It's just how we're wired. And so if the people at the top look a certain way, they're going to naturally push people that are like them forward. So it's such a complicated thing. I struggle with it all the time, you know? And I don't know, maybe, you know, I'll push this question to you, Alex, and you, Krishna. Is the best way to really push the envelope forward to start your own thing? Like, for you, Alex, I would just say, well, you'd want to start your own brand or marketing agency, and you'd really be able to make a difference, because then you'd really be able to do whatever the heck you wanted. As long as you work in a corporate structure, you're not going to really be able to do what you want. So is that the secret? Like, how do we, or is it that we just keep doing things like this? Where we really talk about it and you know, get the word out there, and eventually, you know, we'll slowly change things. What do you think is the secret?
Damn, what a question to answer, eh?
I don't even know if I asked a straightforward question.
We need to get Krishna's POV on this, but I'll take
it. Don't push the question in. Answer the damn question, Alex. I asked you.
He's got like a hypothetical gun. that's a tough one, man. Yeah, got me stumped.
My view is, we don't need to be patient, but one person can't play all the roles. Where for me, I essentially chose my path, which is, you know, go into a top management consultancy, McKinsey and Company, go into, you know, a large publicly traded company. Those are choices where you're saying, I'm going to be part of the system and I will try to engender slow change by being sort of a role model for other people of color who want to follow a similar path, but I'm not going to be this loud voice for change. I've also been incredibly fortunate. Someone like, you know, Heather Reisman looked at me and created an opportunity for me. Like, there are people out there who will do that for you along that journey. That said, there's other people who say, forget that slow path. I can't do that. I'm going to be the person who builds something new and really highlights and talks about the lack of fairness in so many ways, whether it can be how much of venture capital goes to people in color. I think it's disproportionately goes to white male founders. There are things that we have to be able to talk about as fact-driven and call out in order to drive a course correction. But any single individual can't be all of those things. And I think there's also this part where people of color have to sort of look at it as we're all in this together. There's not a battle to see who is the, you know, most preferred model minority. And I think that's historically something that has been done, has been true. And I think that's sort of the way we have to look at things, come at these discussions with a real fact base and be prepared to engage on that discussion of, yes, of course we agree, you should hire the best person. That hasn't been happening for the last 100 years. So now let's actually do that.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I think, yeah, you definitely did put me at ease there. Because I think of, you know, I think of people like, you know, someone I admire and a good friend of mine, Lily Singh. Lily's very outspoken about this. She talks about it all the time. And it's also because of the way that she's set herself up. She built her own brand like 15 mm-hmm. years ago. She's very outspoken about it and she does a good job. It doesn't mean I have to be that way. That actually makes me feel a lot better mm-hmm. because, yeah, I do love working within the studio system. So it doesn't mean that I have to do that. You know, she can drive home, you know, the message forward in her own way because that's the way she does it. Maybe I can be a role model to a few people that then, you know, push forward in the next generation. So exactly. I think that was a really mm-hmm. good way to put it. You're yeah. right. We don't all have to do it the same way.
Krishna, you know? Thank yeah. you for helping put Mina's mind at ease. I appreciate you. He's been an excellent guest, but also a therapist to Mina.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so speaking of therapists, the one thing I want to end on is you look fantastic. Okay.
I appreciate
you
that.
Really do. And it's not just the fashion, your pristine. Skin, your mm-hmm. hair. What are you doing, man? Give us some secrets here. What do you do to maintain? Yeah. You said you're turning 50 next year.
Next year, yeah.
You July look fantastic.
So, look, I think almost everything we have been told about health and, to me, happiness is wrong. And so I have personally always been a contrarian. So never drank. I've been a vegetarian or a pescatarian for the vast majority of my life. I work at a standing desk, so I don't sit in one place. Definitely work out very regularly. And I think there are these set of choices that you can make. Sleep, I think, is obviously the other one that is incredibly important. I think if you're willing to make a set of choices that are against the norm, and look, those choices are also quite isolating.
And difficult.
Like, you know, people bond over drinking, people bond over eating. You know, as being at sort of McKinsey and being in, there's client entertaining that comes with it, and working for a client in Dallas, and we all collectively go to a steakhouse and they're like, you can have a baked potato with butter.
Yeah.
Like, you just have to be willing to be the weird one in the group. It shouldn't feel like that when you're making choices that I think are positive and pay off in the long term. But I think if you want that, you have to be willing to be different.
Yeah, yeah. I know how difficult it is too. You know, I'm plant-based and yeah, it's difficult. Or there are some weeks where I'm like, I don't want to drink, and it's difficult to go out and be like, I'll just have a water or sparkling water or whatever it is.
The world is made to make you feel awkward and strange for making different choices. Like, if you go to a social event and ask for a sparkling water, they'll hand it to you in the biggest, most awkward glass possible.
Yeah.
Just stick out like a sore thumb.
And what about skincare routine? Any of that? Or is it really just the big choices like you talked about?
I think all of that comes after. And my wife is far more advanced on the skincare path than I am. So she would be mortified.
You don't do anything like out of the norm.
Nothing
you know?
Out of the norm.
Yeah, no.
No, well. Cleanser, moisturizer, very straightforward skincare. Because frankly, all the other stuff has way more benefit. Not drinking, eating healthy, working out, sleeping, I think all has more benefit to your skin than any other product will.
Than putting on a serum, yeah. Well, yeah, you look fantastic, I gotta say. Okay. Me and Alex were saying his skin looks better than us. And we're,
I know. You know, honestly, it looks like it's like best to
it's
worst
the studio. No, it's a studio lighting.
No, you look fantastic.
You do. I want to leave on this last note and piece of advice. Something we like to end off in the podcast is for the next diverse entrepreneur, any advice for somebody who is ethnically diverse that's trying to make a splash as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I think it is really about this resolute focus and belief in what you're building. You will be told over and over again that you should change something or do it differently. And I think the great entrepreneurs I've seen, they have this belief in what they're doing and kind of drive towards that. And I think the thing that I would hope to see more of is entrepreneurial people of color creating their own forums and helping each other. So in my generation, we look to mentors, people ahead of us to create opportunity. Heather Reisman did that for me. Joe Mimran did that for me. I would love to see more peer-to-peer opportunity creation. And it doesn't just need to be all in the same industry. As we've talked about, the entertainment industry and fashion and luxury have crossover to sport. It's how do you create new communities, new networks that can help each other?
Amazing.
That's a fantastic.
Great
I love
way
that.
To end this podcast. Thank you so much, Krishna.
Great. Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Appreciate no, it. Really thank you for it. Coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in and listening. Please subscribe, share, and join the journey of Growth Untold. Don't miss a single nugget. Hit that follow button now on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and Instagram.